I'm impressed with how many people came out at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. All right, Brother Alvin, would you lead us in prayer? Now, some of you were not here the first session where we talked about the importance of singing and the fact that a person who does not sing is spiritually handicapped. I didn't say they couldn't be a Christian, but they're missing a very important resource that God has given us to invoke his presence and to have his aid in all of life. And so I always approach this whole subject assuming that every person in the community should learn to sing, and effort should be made to make sure that happens. Now, nothing happens automatically except sin. And so where you have something good happening, somebody has put forth some effort. The Bible talks about God seeking for a man to stand in the gap. And it doesn't say men, it says man. It'd be good if it were men, but he only needs one. And there are certain communities known as singing communities, Hartville, Ohio, South Boston, and other communities you could mention that are known. They're just known as singing communities. And I will guarantee you that if you dug back into the history of that community, you would find maybe more than one, but you're going to find at least one man who was responsible for that community becoming a singing community. At Hartville, Ohio, I knew some of the people involved in some of these communities. At Hartville, Ohio, it would have been John Overholt. You had a group of Amish people who formed a church. They had, like many Amish, they don't, you know, have the kind of knowledge of music. They're singers, they sing their own music, but they don't learn the things that you need to learn to sing the kind of music we sing. So he had a bunch of raw recruits, and he taught in their Christian day school. He constantly formed little singing classes. He formed choirs of all sorts. He brought all kinds of music to the community and stimulated enthusiasm and anticipation to learn to sing and turned the community into a singing community, just basically by dint of his determination that everyone would learn to sing. Another case is South Boston. You go back in that history 100 years ago, almost the beginning of the last century, there was a man there by the name of Henry Good. And the people there will tell you about this man. He's a living memory. He taught his family to sing. He had a large family of about 9 children. And the children will tell you that one of the things they remember well is him sitting in the living room with his pointer and his charts and drilling his children on music. He was constantly holding singing classes. He was constantly getting little groups together. He was constantly bringing new music to the community to inspire them and to sing, and basically turned that community into a singing community. And if you go there today, South Boston is a singing community. And I'm saying all that to say, you came here to hear about song leaders. I'm saying all that to say that if there's a deficiency in the church in terms of singing, somebody needs to take the responsibility to be a leader in making sure that every person in that community learns to sing. Now, the other evening, some of you weren't here, a real key to that is making sure that all the children learn to carry a tune before they're 11 years of age. In that window of opportunity where a child automatically learns to speak a foreign language, even though he's never taught, he's just immersed in it during that period because his parents speak it, he will learn to speak that language without almost any effort. What most people are not aware of is that same wind of opportunity applies to music. That a child will naturally learn to carry a tune if somebody makes sure that he hears nothing but the melody frequently. If he comes to church, he hears harmony. He'll never get ear training there. If he listens to recorded music, he's going to hear harmony. He's not going to get ear training there. If the mother sings in the home, That was my good privilege. My mother was a singer, and all of us children automatically developed a good ear for music because our mother sang the melody. We weren't just hearing music at church when it was harmony or when somebody put on a recording. The other thing that I think you need to be careful about, and you need to urge this, is the teachers in your Christian day school and in your Sunday school that are teaching students up to grade 3 or 4, which is that window of opportunity, don't spend a lot of time singing harmony, that they spend most of the time singing melody. When I was a principal of Christian Day School, I basically told the teachers in grades 1 through 3, if you want to sing a few rounds now and then, that's fine. But basically, I want you to sing in unison. The idea of singing in harmony in the first place is something that adults promote. Children don't care. They just love to sing. They love to sing melody. And it's only when some adult thinks they have to sing harmony that they do something different. So your song leaders, if you came here thinking I was only going to talk about people standing up front and singing, I have more than that in mind. I have in mind that each of you will go back to your communities and be a song leader. And the first thing I want to say is this is your, well, not this particular hymnal, but whatever hymnal you have, this is your book. And you should master your hymnal, whatever hymnal it is. You should carry your own copy to church. You should write little notes. If anybody ever calls attention to some word and defines it in the song that gives meaning, you write that in the margin. If you want to tell a hymn, if you want to tell hymn stories, now I don't have these pasted in mine because I have most of them memorized that I know. This doesn't have much of a margin. If you take a piece of paper and you put a little beaded glue down along the edge and you stick it in like that, it becomes part of the book. And your book should just be filled with all kinds of comments as you pick them up along the way. Hymn stories, comments about the hymns, some setting where it blessed somebody in a very unusual way. Keep that in your hymnal. You are the resource person in the congregation to make this book come alive to your congregations. Okay, so make this a working copy, carry your own copy, and become a leader. And interesting people in the songs, people love to hear hymn stories. They love to anything you have to say to give them a better understanding of what this hymn is saying to them. And so I'm talking about leadership in a much larger sense than just standing up and leading on Sunday morning. Now, I want to talk about there are four qualities of all leadership that I think we all need to pay attention to. There are four characteristics of a leader, someone who really does inspire people to follow. Someone who's appointed to be a leader may not be a leader, but if you're really a leader, here are some characteristics that you will have. Number one is excellence, okay? Excellence. God knows, God is known as the Lord of glory, and glory carries the idea of excellence. You talk about the glory of a sunset. You talk about the glory of youth. You talk about the glory of something that is just so perfect that you can't add anything to it. That's what glory is. And God is the Lord of glory, and we are to do things for his glory. All right? Excellence has a compelling effect. In 1955, going back to Hartville, a group of Hartville youth went to EMC, Eastern Mennonite College, and there they ran into a person by the name of Audrey Shank. She was known in the Mennonite church as just about the best alto that you could encounter. And so it wasn't any surprise that a group of young women aspired to sing alto like Audrey Shank. And if you go to Hartville today, there's still altos there, probably a third generation from that influence that sing with that kind of quality, simply because she caused them to aspire to excellence. There are men who try to preach like Denny Keniston. They aspire to that. So if you have somebody committed to excellence, who really does do something in an excellent way, people will aspire to it. Vera Summers, married to John Overholt. Her name now is Vera Overholt. She was just a beautiful soprano. In fact, she went to EMC and asked Mark Stauffer to give her music lessons, voice lessons, and he said, I wouldn't touch your voice. I would only spoil it. Well, there are many people aspired to sing like Vera Summers. So excellence inspires leadership. People aspire to the excellence that they'll see in your life, especially spiritually. The second quality of a good leader is wisdom, all right? A person who is wise sees the total picture. He sees the long-range goal. And God has abounded toward us in all wisdom, it says. And this person is a person who functions in a way that future generations look back and they say, you know, like I was saying about Henry Good and John Overholt, he set us on a good course. But he saw that back there when nobody else saw it. Wisdom is to be able to see things, the realities that other people don't see, and to involve yourself and others in it. All right? The third quality that I would mention is enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. It's interesting that the word enthusiasm, yes, I do have a use for this board. The Greek word for enthusiasm is en, not the Greek word, the French word, theos. Of course, you all know what this means. What's this mean? Theos? God. This literally means filled with God. And that's where the word enthusiasm comes from. So it's sort of an oxymoron if somebody would claim to be a Christian and not have any enthusiasm. And it's interesting that that same basic term is used in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, where it says we're to offer ourselves a living sacrifice. The word there is thusia. I think that's very interesting, all right? So a person who is enthused always attracts people's admiration and inspiration and is a leader. So we have three things here now. We have excellence, we have wisdom, the person who sees something and leads people into something they don't really see themselves, but they follow. And we have enthusiasm. And last of all, steadfastness. Not everybody is going to embrace your vision. There are going to be people who say, we don't agree with you. Nah. You have to learn to meet that with steadfastness, with kindness, with grace, but you don't quit. You don't quit. You're going to meet opposition, I guarantee you. And most people don't know how to handle opposition. They either fight their opposition or they quit and walk away. The person who really gets the job done is a person who knows how to kindly meet that opposition with graciousness, but he doesn't quit. I came to a school one time where there were 27 students in the high school, 18 boys and 9 girls. The girls, the boys didn't sing. There was only one boy in that class who could even carry a tune, and the rest of them. The teacher told me when I came to that school, you'll sing a solo for devotion. They will not sing. So I announced to them at the beginning of the school year that all of you will learn to sing. The boys couldn't sing. They couldn't carry a tune. You will either learn to sing during music class or during phys ed, so you can decide when you want to learn to sing. So we built a little negative motivation in there. But in the process, there were three boys in the high school who were the leaders. They were very fine young men. They were respectable. They were clean morally. They were just good boys. But they made up the three, and they were the three oldest boys, and probably had the most influence. They would not sing. And so, of course, I began to work on them. And their father came to me after a few days. And again, he was a very gracious man. He did not come to cause me any grief. He came actually to save me from wasting my time. He said, "You don't understand. Our family is a non-singing family, and you are wasting your time. These boys cannot learn to sing." And I said, "Well, will you permit me to differ with you? Your boys can learn to sing, and they will learn to sing, and they will enjoy singing." And he left. And we kept working on it. Those boys all learned to sing. They learned to sing, not only carry a tune, they learned to sing a part. I sat beside them when they were seniors in devotions and heard them sing good bass, good tenor. And those boys have all come back to thank me for giving them the best gift that they could imagine anyone could have given them. But I didn't quit. I didn't fight. I didn't argue with the dad. And I didn't fight with the boys. I just kept on with my program. And so I guarantee you that if you're going to give any leadership that has a wise and large perspective that other people don't see, you're going to run into opposition. But just keep right on. Keep right on with the belief that what you're doing is very important, that everybody can learn to sing, And once they do learn to sing, they will thank you for it. And you just keep right on. The fact of the matter is, in that school where the students did not sing, they only not only could not sing, they would not sing. They didn't believe they could sing. The third year of that school, we sang the Hallelujah Chorus for the school program at the end of the year. And when we started out, they had the Christian hymnal, which is filled with a lot of light music. And I brought the church hymnal, which has heavier music. And the students called that class Music Class. They hated that book because it didn't have your jumpy, lively stuff in that they were used to singing. But at the end of 7 years of teaching, there's no doubt in my mind if you'd taken a vote from those students which hymnal they wanted in their church, it would have been the church hymnal. And so there's got to be, if your vision is true, you can just keep plugging away, smiling at the opposition, being very gracious to them, but just straight on ahead, okay? So there's a couple things that I wanted to point out. Now, I wanted to put in a plug for Mennonite a cappella singing. I can't make a biblical case for a cappella singing, but I can make a very practical case, and I think I owe it to you to do that today. I want to read to you an article written by Alice Parker. This appeared in the Gospel Herald, the Mennonite publication, in 1961. Now, before 1961, the Mennonites were plain, and they'd have never had a woman like this with cut hair and no covering come into their circles. But the Mennonites had become liberal enough by this point. They invited this woman to come and hold workshops at Laurelville Camp near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And this was her first encounter with Mennonite singing. She was a professional. She wrote arrangements for the Robert Shaw Chorale and other professional chorales, but she'd never heard Mennonites sing. And so I'm going to read this to you. This is very instructive. I will never forget my first arrival at Laurelville Mennonite Church Center for Family Music Week in July 1961. In the dining hall, after a brief grace, one voice began without announcement a familiar hymn. On the second note, the entire room joined in the most beautiful four-part hymn singing I had ever heard. I hear it in my mind's ear to this day. It gives me a vision of what hymn singing must have been in the past and what it could be in the days to come. How could the singing of a group of people in the mountains of western Pennsylvania strike my ear so memorably? I think I had subconsciously assumed that there was an unbridgeable gap between what amateur singers could do, particularly church congregations, and the sound of highly trained professional choruses. It had never occurred to me that a tradition of unaccompanied singing, along with a natural, free vocal production and a love for and understanding of the text, could add up to the kind of sound I was hearing. My first impression was confirmed in the next years as I came to know several Mennonite congregations and was always rewarded with that same rich sound. What was it composed of? Number one, a true function. The voices supplied all the music for worship. Each voice was needed and appreciated, young and old joining together. The congregation was literally united, bound together in singing, which expressed their deepest beliefs. Number two, the strength of their tradition, in which a child grew up in the midst of part singing. The parents taught melodies and harmonies, as well as words and beliefs, as they sang at home and in church. Number three, the quality of the ensemble singing. The listening which made beginnings and endings come exactly together, the text clear and expressive, the pitches well-tuned and in balance. Number four, the frequent appearance of duets and trios and quartets singing hymns as special music, affording opportunities for individuals to practice carrying their parts alone. Number five, the frequent use of song leaders who, in addition to announcing and starting the hymns, provided visual and audible examples of adults who loved to sing. This also gave valuable lessons in conducting anyone who tried it. But first was the sound. I had read about and heard groups of shape note singers who sounded authentically primitive, raw, ugly voices bursting with energy. How could these singers sound so different? It had to be the result of an unbroken tradition, sustained by truly musical leaders in each generation. Good singing begets good singing when the chain is not broken. And that's our concern. Another indelible Laravel memory pictures an evening worship time. A quartet was singing with a beautiful blend of voices. The stairs to the balcony were filled with children. Faces intent on the singers caught in the mood which embraced us all. They must have been thinking, when I grow up, I'm going to sing like that. Consider for a moment what happens when the chain is broken. Now here's the part I want you to hear. The introduction of a piano or an organ divides the responsibility for the sound between the voices and the instrument, lessening the need for total congregational involvement. Keyboard instruments are not good models for singing. They produce sound very differently, not accounting for words or breathing or the subtle turns of phrasing natural to voices. When parents stop singing, the children don't start. When the song leader disappears, the model is gone. When a group gets used to following a piano or organ, the ensemble skills disappear. Listening to each other is no longer important. And I will say this, the last service I was in where there was a piano, it was up in the corner, and it was played very discreetly. It struck me that I could not really hear the other people singing. That got between me and all the other singers, and I almost felt like I was singing by myself. So she's making a real point here, that an instrument destroys the responsibility for everybody to take responsibility for the sound, and it also gets between the singers. And when choirs and soloists drain the good voices from the congregation, it cannot find its own voice. The sound of the United Church makes from all its people. The scenario above is found all over the country. Our popular culture breeds a passive audience demanding to be entertained, preferably by professionals, in songs which reflect the lowest common denominator of words and music. Mennonites have never been noted for accepting the popular culture and knowing their own history, believing they are a people set apart. They have succeeded in preserving many values that the rest of the world seems to have lost. The hymn singing congregation, which combines beauty with belief, is part of that heritage. That sound at Laurelbell changed the direction of my life. How many others still have a chance to hear it? Those singers rejoice daily in the fact that God gave us ears, voices, and the gift of music. May they long continue to return a worthy offering in song, which opens every heart and unites every voice in prayer and praise. I thought you would be blessed by hearing that. All right. So I would like to talk now about song leading specifically. Let me get my notes here together. The first thing we want to talk about is prepare the heart to sing. Prepare the heart to sing honestly. All right? The Bible says, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. So the song leader leads with his life, first of all, as a person who exemplifies true worship. And what is true worship? Well, the old English word for worship is worth. That is the old, you look it up in the dictionary. This was the original definition of worship. Worthship, the thing to which you attribute the highest and most important value in your life. And the song leader should exemplify a person who truly worships. God is truly number one in his life. That probably is one of the most important qualifications for a song leader. And how do you know if God's number one in your life? Go home and ask your wife. Go home and ask your children. Go ask the people you work with. What gets you the most excited? That's what you worship. That's what's number one in your life. There's some people that say that's Jesus, but everybody knows the thing that gets them the most excited is the new tractor they bought, or their herd of cows, or their business, or the vacation they're planning, or some sport that they're involved in, or the car they drive. That if you want to push their button and get them talking and get them excited, it's those things, not Jesus. And so a song leader's life should be an example of someone who Jesus is the number one passion of his life. And that will be exuded in his singing. That will just literally come through in the way he regards all worship, including singing. There's no point in singing, "Fully surrendered, Lord divine, I will go with thee all the way." You're not going to lead the congregation in worshiping with that song if that's not true of your life. You know, we sometimes sing that song, Take My Life and Let It Be, and I always sort of smile because I think most people would like to take it just as the title says it, Take My Life and Let It Be. Or we say, take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold. Really? People sing that who hold on with all their might. So, or Lord, I am fondly, earnestly longing, dead to the world, alive unto thee. I will go with thee all the way, all of thy bidding will obey. It's wonderful if you have a man who really lives that and calls the congregation's attention to these words. If he tries to do that and they know he doesn't live it, that won't mean anything. So the first part, the most important part of any leader, whether it's a preacher, whether it's a song leader, is that they lead in true worship with their entire life. And whatever these songs say is exemplified by the song leader himself. All right? The second important thing is lead into the spirit and message of the song. The Bible says, I will praise thee, O Lord, with my whole heart, Psalm 9:1. All that is within me, all that is within me, bless his holy name. Our whole being should be involved in the message of the song. And the mind is most important because the Bible says we are renewed in the spirit of our minds. Without understanding, all else is superfluous. We must sing with understanding. We must pay attention to what we're singing. I mean, we sing all kinds of... Do you know the Quakers don't sing? Once in a while, someone will stand up and say the Spirit led them to lead a song, and then they'll sing. But they don't characteristically have any scheduled singing. Do you know why? I don't know what the modern Quakers would say. Some of them have become sort of evangelical. But the old silent Quakers would have told you the reason they don't sing is because most people do the most lying when they sing. And they did not want to involve their congregations in things where people were forced to lie. And that's why they don't sing. And we should learn what these songs mean. Would you turn to 807 in this hymnal? No, I want you to turn to it in this hymnal, and I also want you to turn to it in this hymnal. I don't know what the number is in this one. It's 807 in this hymnal. Just give me a second here. 315 in this hymnal. I want you to make a comparison. I want you to look, read the first line and the punctuation in Hymns of the Church, and then I want you to look in the Christian Hymnary 315 and see if you see a difference. There's a question mark at the end of every line in Hymns of the Church. I don't know why John Overholt missed that. Because if you miss that, you miss the meaning of this song. The way it should sing, of course, the way it should be read is this way. Peace, perfect peace, in this dark world of sin? Really? The blood of Jesus whispers peace within. Peace, perfect peace, by thronging duties pressed to do the will of Jesus. This is rest. And it's a question down through every stanza. And you should call that the congregation's attention to that. I mean, obviously John Overholt missed it, who was a very competent man. And maybe he just took these words out of another hymnal and they didn't happen to have the question mark. But somehow it got missed in the Christian hymnary. That is a very, very important fact about this hymn. In fact, to really bring out the meaning of this hymn, I have already had the women sing the question and the men sing the answers. Because we can't do anything in music to make it sound like a question. You can't sing so that first line sounds like a question. So you have to call attention to it, and you have to maybe do something to emphasize the fact that the first line asks a question, the second line gives the answer. Well, let's turn to another one. Let's turn to 394 in the Hymns of the Church. These are the things that you should be noting in the margins as you learn them down through the years. You should be able to accumulate down through the years things that you pick up, things you observed, things you heard other people say, things you read in books to make these songs meaningful. 394. Now, did you ever notice in the last line, it says, that soul though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never forsake. Now, there was a lady told me one time she couldn't understand why in the world that was repeated over and over and over in the last line of this song. What she was not aware of is this song is based on Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. And let me read it to you in the Amplified Bible. The Amplified Bible tries to add extra terms to give the nuances of the Greek terms that are missing when you just translate it into English with a limited amount of vocabulary. So let me read it to you in the Amplified. God himself has said, I will not in any way fail you, nor give you up, nor leave you without support. I will not in any degree leave you helpless, nor forsake you, let you down, relax my hold on you. Assuredly not. So there's a fivefold statement by God that he will not forsake us. And that's why he put that fivefold statement in this song. This man knew that verse. Apparently he knew Greek. And he knew that emphasis over and over in Hebrews 13:5 was there. So he put that in this text. Don't be like the song leader that went to a funeral. And it was one of those churches where funerals weren't planned very specifically, and he was to lead the singing, and he didn't choose any songs, so he came and he opened up his hymnal, and he led the first song that appeared, and it happened, and this was at a funeral. It was Not All the Blood of Beasts, and that's what he led for the funeral. And it didn't go too bad till they got to the verse that says, believing we rejoice to see the curse removed. The family was not amused. Dear Lord and Father of mankind, are you aware of the fact that the text that we have is only the last part of a long poem? How many knew that? See, and your congregations won't know it either. You can turn to the song, which you will find on 118. And I'm going to read you the rest of the poem. And somewhere along the line, your congregation should hear this. Look on the left-hand side, and you will see that this song was written by John Greenleaf Whittier. Does anybody know who he was? You never heard of John Greenleaf Whittier? John Greenleaf Whittier was a Quaker. He wrote that famous poem, Snowbound. Maybe you've never heard of that either. But anyway, he was a very famous Quaker poet. He was an abolitionist. He was totally opposed to slavery. And he wrote some abolitionist literature during that time and helped the Quakers to get slavery out of the Quaker fellowships. But he was a Quaker, and you have to know that to understand this song. Tell me what the first thing is that comes to your mind when you hear Quaker. What's that? Silence. I told you they don't sing because they don't want people to lie. And they don't do a lot of speaking in their services because they don't want a bunch of insincerity. They want, if somebody speaks, they want it to be moved by the Holy Spirit. And if the Holy Spirit doesn't move anybody to say anything, they want you to sit there with your own meditations. Okay? But John Greenleaf Whittier was living in the era of the revivals at the end of the 1700s. And these were German Methodist revivals, and they were very noisy. The preaching was loud. People were shouting amen. People were waving their hands in the air. They didn't have altar calls in those days. By the way, I will clue you in. Altar calls began with Charles Finney in the early 1800s. I'm a little amazed that we borrowed that method. But anyway, they didn't have those. But they had all the other accompaniments of a very noisy revival. And on the way home, he was disgusted. As a Quaker, that had offended all of his sensibilities as to what true worship was. So he went home and he wrote this poem. It's called The Brewing of the Soma. The soma, back in the ancient records of India, was a weed that they got the sap from it, and they fermented it, and then they distilled it, and it was a drug. It wasn't just alcohol. It was a drug like marijuana. And the point that he makes in this, I'm going to give you the point so you understand it when I read it. The point he makes is people have always been trying some artificial way to get closer to God. They do it with drugs. They do it with noisy meetings. They do it with all kinds of things to get people riled up. And he doesn't think that's right. So here's what he says. The faggots blazed, the cauldron smoke up through the green wood curled. Bring honey from the hollow oak, bring milky sap, the brewer spoke in the childhood of the world. So he says this goes the whole way back to the beginning of the world. People have been doing this ever since who knows when, trying to come up with some formula, some psyched experience to get closer to God. And brewed they well or brewed they ill, the priests thrust in their rods, first tasted, then drank their fill, and shouted with one voice of will, behold the drink of gods. They drank, and lo, in heart and brain, a glad new life began. The gray of hair grew young again. The sick man laughed away his pain. The crippled leaped and ran. Drink, mortals, what the gods have sent. Forget your long annoy, so sang the priest. From tent to tent, the soma's sacred madness went, a storm of drunken joy. Then knew each, wrapped in ebriate, or drunkard, a winged and glorious birth, soared upward with strains, joy elate, beat with dazed head, Varuna's gate, Varuna was a god, and sobered, sank to earth. The land with Soma's praises rang on Gihon's banks of shade. In its hymns the dusky maidens sang. In joy of life or mortal sang, all men to Soma prayed. The morning twilight of the race sends down these matin psalms, and still with wondering eyes we trace the simple prayers to Soma's grace that Vedic verse embalms. Vedic verse would be the literature of India. As in that child world's early year, each after age has striven by music, incense, vigils drear, or trance to bring the skies more near or lift men up to heaven. Some fever of the blood and brain, some self-exalting spell, the scourger's keen delight of pain, the dervish dance, the Orphic strain, the wild-haired Bacchant's yell, the desert's hair-grown hermit sank, the saner brute below, the naked sant and hish-hash drunk, the cloister madness of the monk, the faker's torture show. And he's listing all the different things down through history that people have done. And yet the past comes round again, and new doth old fulfill. In sensual transports, wild as vain, we brew in many a Christian fane the heathen soma still. Dear Lord and Father of mankind, forgive our foolish ways. Reclothe us in our rightful mind, in purer lives thy service find, in deeper reverence praise. In simple trust like theirs who heard beside the Syrian sea the gracious calling of the Lord, let us like them, without a word, rise up and follow thee. O Sabbath rest by Galilee, O calm of hills above, where Jesus knelt to share with thee the silence of eternity interpreted by love. Somehow I missed the last verse. With that deep hush subduing all, our words and works that drown the tender whisper of thy call, as noiseless let thy blessing fall as fell the manna down. Drop thy still dews of quietness till all our striving cease. Take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. Breathe through the heats of our desire thy coolness and thy balm. Let sense be dumb, let flesh retire. Speak through the earthquake, wind, and fire, O still small voice of calm. It's a very instructive hymn if you know what he was saying and what he was contrasting his view with. What he's basically saying is, shut up and live it. If you want to put it in a very vernacular context. I want you to turn to 387. I'm just pointing out a few things. And this one, I'm not sure I stopped to think like I should have. Did I say 555? That's what I meant. 555. Anything you can do to get people to focus on what the song is actually saying, because we are so prone when we're doing something familiar to just mindlessly sing and we're not thinking. All right, this is what it says. Rock of ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flowed be of sin the double cure. What is the double cure? Now we sing this, and we're praying that the sin would receive a double cure. Let's make it practical, brother. Yeah. Okay, it's in the next phrase. Be of sin the double cure, cleanses from its guilt, past, wipe the record clean, and its power to live a holy life in the future. We're praying for both of those things when we sing. Now, here again, I don't want to criticize the Christian hymnal, and I don't know where John Overholt was when he was doing this, but if you look there, you'll see that he took that word out, double cure, double, and he put the word perfect in there. I kind of think he thought this was talking about the second work of grace, because Augusta Toplady had been part of the Wesley holiness movement, and John Overholt must have mistakenly thought that he was talking about a second work of grace. But he is not talking about a second work of grace. He's talking about the two things that the blood does. It cleanses the record past, and it gives us the power to keep the record clean. And if you don't call that to people's attention, they'll sing double cure for the rest of their life and never notice that the song explains what that double cure is and what the blood really does for us. So, the point that I'm making is, lead into the spirit and message of the song. You shouldn't walk into church and choose your songs on the way in. You should have these chosen beforehand. You should have done as much study of the song as you possibly can to understand its message. If there's anything about the author, if there's anything about the circumstances under which the song was written, it's your responsibility to learn as much of that as you possibly can. And the congregation will always sing the song with more meaning once you've pointed that out. All right? The third point, call to wholehearted participation. Now, the first thing you should do, my wife, this is a major issue with her, you should say the number very clearly and loudly twice. And you should also say the title of the song. So in case they miss the number, they can go to the index and they can find the song. And everybody can have the song in front of them when they begin singing. Now, I don't always do that, so it's do as I say, not as I do. All right. Call to wholehearted participation. There's a song in this book that says, "Come, my soul, thou must be waking. Now is dawning a new day." It takes effort to be all there when we sing. The soul must be aroused from its sluggishness. It's a pet peeve of mine to look across the congregation and see somebody who's looking around, they sing every other word, just sort of mumbling along, being dragged along by the congregation. That really, really bugs me. If you want me to really not have a good opinion of you, you do that, all right? Try to inspire wholehearted participation. The first thing that I would mention is make sure that they hear the pitch loud and clear. You don't just start singing without a pitch. Now, maybe you don't have a pitch pipe, but it bugs me when somebody says, "We're going to sing number 90. And they sing, "Joy to the world." What's going to happen? Tell me what's going to happen. 3, 4, 5 words into the song, people are going to start. They have no clue where to start. And so in our congregation, we have made a real issue over the fact, some people don't do it well anyway, that you blow the pitch. Do and then maybe go to the pitch the song starts on, so that everybody, you can't expect people to start on the first word if they don't know what the pitch is going to be. They have to know what the pitch of that first note is. And then the next thing is, I try to get across to people that the most important word in the song is the first word. And then I say, and what is the most important word in the second verse? The first word. And what's the most important word in the third verse? The first word. And you get the point. And you, in fact, if you do, if you instill in your congregation the things I'm saying here, you really don't need a leader standing up front. In our congregation, we don't have a leader who stands up front. Our leaders all lead from their seats. But we have taught them. Now, the only reason for a leader up front is if he's going to interpret the song. He's actually going to lead the congregation. He's going to slow them down at certain places. He's going to get more volume, quiet them down, you know, tempo and volume. And so he's going to regulate all that to interpret. If he's going to do that, then he can stand up front. If he's not going to do that, all of the things we're talking about can be done from his seat if the congregation is trained. They hear the number, they have the page, they have the pitch, and they're ready to sing the first note. People who come to our church comment, it's amazing. In this church, unfortunately. But for the most part, this congregation sings its songs from the first word. But that's years and years and years of fussing on the part of people like me. Okay? So, begin on the first word of every stanza and train your congregations to do that. And it can be done. But it has to be something that you purpose to do. If you just let it go on year by year the way it is, that's the way it'll be forever. A leader sees what needs to be done, and he does whatever he needs to do to change it, and that's something that needs to be changed. People should start on the very first word.
So, may I ask a question?
Sure. Yeah, anytime you want to ask questions.
So, to me, I agree that's very important. To me, along with all being able to start together, you need to be able to see the leader and give a signal.
Well, in our congregation, our people know that when somebody goes, well, yeah, that doesn't even work. Well, that doesn't work either. I'm getting it. Do, and they know then we're going to sing. Yeah. They know about how much time it's going to be between the pitch and the first note. I'm not against people standing up front. But to me, some person standing up here going, and not doing anything different than anybody would do if they were sitting at their seat, to me, that's a distraction. But maybe that's just me. Does somebody else have more defense for a song leader standing up front who just waves his hands around and distracts the congregation? And sometimes they distract me because they're not even beating time right, and that really distracts me. that's really bad. Okay. In other words, well, then he should be sitting in his seat. He might as well let the congregation determine the tempo. Okay. Now, I'm not making a case for people sitting in their seat. The point I was trying to make is, if you do what I'm saying well, your congregation, unless you're going to interpret the song, will do what they need to do without a leader. That's the point I'm trying to make. They really don't need someone standing up front unless he's going to really lead the song. Well, you'll just be one note behind, but the rest of the congregation will carry you along. No, listen, I'm not making a case against people standing up front. The point I was trying to make is, if you do your work well, it won't make that much difference unless he leads the song. That's the point I'm making. All right? Teach people to open their mouths when they sing. The Bible says, I will greatly praise the Lord with my mouth. Okay? You cannot sing with your teeth clenched. I don't understand how people do it. In order to sing, oh, you have to have a big, you can't sing, oh. I look at people singing, I can't imagine what their vowels must sound like. You've got to open your mouth. Professional singers say on the open vowels like oh and ah, you should have three fingers. I'll guarantee you, I'll be happy if you just do two. And you should call attention to that, that they should have their mouths open on O and ah, on E. In fact, when they sing a short I, that should be sung E instead of I. I does not make a nice musical sound. It doesn't make a clear enunciation. Short I's are E's, okay? And oo, I mean, of course, when I say open mouth, I'm talking about A and O. The mouth should be open on those words. All right? The third point. Insist that people pronounce their words clearly and correctly. Let me put a word up here. We have a song, at least one song, that has this word in it. How is that word pronounced? Waneth. Does your congregation all say waneth, but his mercy waneth never? And if they say waneth, I say, would somebody please tell me what the word waneth means? All right. What about this one? He bade me welcome, O word of mercy. That's what most people say. It happens to be bad. Okay. So, make sure they say the words the right way. Fourth point that I would make under this particular aspect that we're talking about, wholehearted participation. Follow the exact tempo. Whatever tempo is established, be sure to follow an exact tempo. If the song leader starts out, "Come thou almighty King," then make sure that you're not behind the tempo or you're not ahead of it. Most people aren't going to be ahead of it. Make sure you're not behind. Draggy singing has nothing to do with the speed at which a song is sung. It has everything to do with how alert and exact people are on the tempo. But most people, let's say these are notes, most people are just a little bit behind on the tempo with every note. I don't say you should be ahead, but in your mind, you should be feeling attention toward the next note when you're singing. Okay? How many of you have a metronome somewhere that you have access to? Raise your hands. Use the metronome. And most congregations will be shocked at how much they lose on the tempo with every note. The difference between professional singers and amateur singers has to do with these things. Professional singers are on the money. I mean, their tempo, they're right on the money. Their pronunciation is right. Their mouths are open. They start on the first note. I mean, those are all things. In fact, we had an Amish visitor in our community, and he wrote an article on music after he got sometime here recently, and I'm almost positive he was referring to our congregation because I wasn't there the Sunday he stopped in to visit. He was an Amishman on the way home from another meeting. He stopped to visit our community. And then he wrote an article on music recently, and he said, "I recently visited a liberal Mennonite congregation," which he would have considered ours to be, and I'm pretty sure he was talking about us. And he said, "I was shocked at the concert quality of the singing." Well, if he was talking about our congregation, that was a great compliment. Not that we're not concert singers, but the reason he felt that way was because he heard people start on the first note. He heard a tempo that was lively. It didn't drag. He heard people singing with their mouths open, just doing these things that we're talking about. That's what he heard. And we worked for years in our congregation. When we started, we adopted the church hymnal, and we decided we'd learn the whole entire hymnal, every song in it. So every other week, we had prayer meeting every other week, and in between, we had music practice. We sang some sheet music, but we also spent a lot of time with the hymnal. perfecting the songs that needed some work done on them, teaching people how to sing, and helping them to do the things we're talking about. And so our congregation basically does what I'm describing to you, and a visitor said it was concert quality. That was a nice compliment, which he meant to be a criticism. But anyway, sing the notes correctly. We have songs in our hymnals that we do not sing correctly. How many were here the other night when we sang Great God Indulge? And I fussed at the altos. How many were here? Well, why don't we look at that one for just a second, for those of you who weren't here. 85. I mean, you can sing the song wrongly, and you can worship, and it's not going to maybe be any great hindrance, but it just adds so much to it if we are precise on some things. Those of you who were not here, the word above make at the end of the song, that alto note is a re. Almost all congregations that I have led in singing this song, the ladies sing the do, because that harmonizes. The re is dissonant. It's meant to be dissonant. It's meant to add a bit of tension there to be resolved with that do that follows. But I've had very few congregations that sing that the altos, you can hear that every alto in the congregation has hit that re square, and you hear that wonderful dissonance resolve itself. So you work on things like that. Or turn to 84. No, that's not right. 774. Let's sing the third score, just right here. Let's sing it. And you'll probably sing it right, but many congregations do not. And now that I've said that, you'll probably sing it right. But anyway, that's okay. This is Love Divine, All Loves Excelling. Jesus, come on, folks, sing it. Do, ready, G. Okay, you did what I thought. You sang a so. What is the note there? It's a sharp so. But almost all congregations sing a so. They don't sing the sharp. And if they sing if the sharp is sung, that is a fabulous chord. If it's not sung, it's whatever it is. All right, let's sing it right now. Do, ready? Jesus, thou art all compassion. How many know that your congregation sings it that way? Uh-huh. All right, so somewhere outside the worship service, hopefully, you need to correct that. Let's look at another one. Let's look at 701. But let's start at Break Down Every Idol and sing to the chorus where it says, I shall be whiter than snow, and we'll stop there then. Okay, Break Down Every Idol. Know me. Break down every idol. Okay, you sang it right. But some people sing what we see later in the song. They sing, now wash me and I. Okay. So as a song leader, you're the watchdog. You're watching for whether the harmony and the melody and everything and the timing and everything is being done correctly. All right? And finally, sing in phrases. Don't pound the song. Don't sing, come thou almighty king. It should be sing, come thou almighty king. It's a legato style. Come thou almighty king. You sing in the phrase. You don't pound the notes. Okay? All right. The fourth main point, and I'll try to wrap this up here quickly. Lead in interpretation of the song. Okay? Lead an interpretation of the song. And that's if you're going to have a chorister stand up front, then let's have the song interpreted. Would you turn to 114 and you follow me? (Clears throat) We're going to sing verses 1, we're going to sing verses 3, 4, and 5, okay? No, and if you stand up front to lead, you should give a little indication, a little upbeat, no matter what beat is supposed to be. If it's even if it's a downbeat, you should give a little upbeat to let the congregation know that the song is ready to start, okay? This happens to be an upbeat, but I would still give a little indication that you're going to start, okay? Do, be, four, J. Oh, I'm sorry, I said verse 3. I didn't do this right. Verse 3, and then you watch me. Do, we are his people, we his care, our souls and all our mortal frame. What lasting honors shall we rear? Almighty Maker, to thy name we'll crowd thy gates with. Come on, you weren't watching me, okay? Sing it. Well, let's sing. All right, we already did it, okay? Let's sing this second verse, this fourth verse, and then keep watching me, please. No, we'll crowd thy gates with thankful songs, high as the heavens are, voices raise. And earth with her 10,000 tongues shall fill thy courts with songs and praise. Wide as the world. That's the point I'm trying to make. If you're going to stand up front, then lead the song. And teach your congregation to watch and make sure you're not standing there in vain, just waving your hands around, especially if you do it wrong. Okay? Number 5, and we're getting to the end here. Bring new songs to the congregation. Bring new songs to the congregation. Now, if you're going to project songs on the wall, it should be new songs. There's no point in projecting songs on the wall if you have a hymnal. And I'm not too much for projecting songs on the wall. I've observed that churches that project songs on the wall, their singing is off the wall. So... I mean, there's nothing technically wrong with projecting songs on a wall, but there should be a reason for it, and there's no reason for it if you have a hymnal, unless you're bringing new songs to the congregation, and you should. You should constantly be coming to the congregation saying, look, I found this really nice song, and it's a beautiful song, and tell them what it means, and get everybody inspired to sing this new song. I want you to turn to 376 as an example of this. And of course, what I have here on my paper, they were new songs when I first gave this message, but now they're in my hymnal. 376. These would have been songs that we brought to our congregation as sheet music years ago. And much of the new music in this hymnal that you're going to sing, I would have brought to the congregation through the years, and we sang it off of sheets, or well, we never sang off the wall. I've always had a pet peeve about off the wall. But anyway, 376. This is a wonderful song that comes from the Bruderhof. And we all know the song that says, deeper, deeper in the love of it. That's sort of a junkie, and it's in here too, for those who want to sing it. But this song has a lot more depth to it. It's just a really nice song. So let's, just as an example of a new song, does anybody know this one? Let's all sing the melody, okay? Do so, deeper and deeper before thee I bow. Care thy abundance of grace on me now. Master, in meekness before thee I fall. Lord, in my life thou shalt be all in all. Deeper and
this world shall satisfy me. Down at thy feet I do cast myself, Lord. Christ be my life and my full reward. Now let's sing the parts. Deeper and deeper with thee may I go, putting aside all this life and its woe. I am unworthy of calling to thee, and yet I know thou wilt answer my plea. Deeper and deeper, deeper in thee, not of this world shall satisfy me. Down at thy feet I do cast myself, Lord. Christ be my life and my full reward.
I think we'll stop there. So, you want to inspire your congregation in every way you possibly can. And let me quickly run back through my points if I can get my notes organized here. You want to be a promoter of excellence. You want to lead your congregation with wisdom into areas where maybe they don't understand, but are really part of reality. You want to do it with enthusiasm, and you want to have steadfastness. You want to prepare hearts to sing honestly, and you do that best by being honest in your own life. And when you say, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee, you're an example of that. Lead into the spirited message of the song with anything that you can point out to the congregation that will help them understand what they're singing, including hymn stories. Call to wholehearted participation, which means singing on the first note, which means opening their mouths, which means pronouncing their words correctly, following an exact tempo, and singing the notes correctly. And then lead into interpretation if you're going to stand up front, bring new songs to the congregation, and in every way inspire people to worship honestly and meaningfully. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Can you give some input into a congregation situation where you have younger people who are very much involved in learning music, and you have an older who never learned it and don't really care to, and combine that as an effective congregation situation?
Well, that is always a challenge. We have people coming into our congregation that didn't have a musical background. David Brousseau, whom you all know probably, was told by his teachers when he was in school that he couldn't sing. And so he was separated from the others when they had music class and sent to a study hall or something, which was horrible. You'd never tell anybody they can't sing. In the first place, it's not true. And so when he came to our congregation, he immediately realized that music was an extremely important part of our congregation, and singing was something we highly valued. And so he came to me and he said, what can I do? And I said, well, let me evaluate. So I sat down and I usually do this. Did you hear the difference? Yes. Well, then you can learn to sing, because you can learn to sing anything you can hear. And so we worked a little bit and I realized that he could actually sing the scale. He could actually match my tones. And so he sat beside me in church for years and sang along with me. And learn to sing a credible bass in his old age. What can you do? One-on-one. Find out which of those people actually want to learn and have sessions with them. If it's an adult and they pass through that window of opportunity, ages 2 to 11, it's a job to get them tuned up. But you can. They have to want to, and they have to stick with it. What you do is you start, you say, sing do, And of course, someone who has not learned to carry a tune will sing, do. Okay, fine, that's where we'll start. Do, re, mi. And after a while, it'll go, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Okay? And there's where your work is, right there. And you use every way you possibly can to get them to. You see, we all have to acquire our upper pitch. Our lower range takes care of itself. You can't make your voice any lower than it is. Okay? Oh, you might be able to do a little bit. But everybody has to always work on their upper range. They have to acquire their upper range. They have to maintain their upper range. If you take voice training, they'll spend a lot of time on your upper range. And people who have not learned to carry a tune have no upper range. When they sing the scale, it's about three notes, and there's where it stops. And then you have to work to help them acquire an upper range. And once they do, then you sing with them and help them match tones when you sing a familiar song. And you just keep working until they finally are able to sing and match their voice with other people. But they have to want to do that. Off pitch. We had a man that came to our congregation. He was a man that, you know, his lane didn't go quite to the road anyway. He was a very nice man. He was very devout, and he loved to sing. And he sang loud and off key. I mean, when he was in church, you could hear him singing off key. Interestingly enough, if he visited and you said, sing Jesus Loves Me, he could sing that on tune. But when he was in the congregation, he lost his sense of pitch completely. One evening, they ushered me in a full congregation to sit beside him. And he told people after the service, he will never sit beside John Martin again. I got him off the pitch. So anyway, you just have to work with it. We have people in our congregation that did not learn to sing, have never expressed any real desire to learn to sing. You just have to let that be. But you do everything you possibly can to help everybody learn to get the idea it's important to sing, and every person who wants to sing can learn to sing. I have never agreed that there are people that can't learn to sing except people who are stone deaf. You can't sing what you can't hear. But I believe every person, why would God command us to sing and then create people who can't? That doesn't make any sense. Does that answer your question? The only problem is if you have music classes, which I would suggest you do, guess who's not going to come? So it is a real problem. You just have to do whatever you can do. Any other questions? You can sit properly if you're seated. Well, I'm not saying it's as good as standing, but you can't be seated like this. It closes off your production. But if you sit with your seated erect and even slightly forward, you can do pretty well. Anybody? You had a question. And they volunteer for every special group you solicit. You're a little bit like Paul. You try to be tactful, but you might not succeed. Paul Erb, who was the editor of the Gospel Herald for years, had this farmer poet somewhere in the Midwest who kept sending him poetry. And it wasn't really poetry, but the farmer thought he knew how to write poetry. So Paul Erb just kept stacking it up on his desk, never published any of it. And finally, one day, he put it all in a big envelope and sent it back to him with this very tactful statement. Perhaps you might like to try to write your thoughts in prose. And the man fired a letter back to him, let them as can't write poetry write prose, which, of course, was the point. So it's a little hard to get those people to understand, and after a while, we don't want to squelch anybody's participation in worship. And after a while, we just have to live with that. But if you can get that person off to the side, that person can learn to sing on pitch. You have to approach it with that from that standpoint. And so, if you can convince that person to take some private training and get that person tuned up, that'll solve the problem. But sometimes we just have to live. We don't have everything we want. Okay? Anybody else have a question?
In that aspect, remember what Jesus said. Do what he did unto the least you did.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we want everybody to participate in worship. That man that I told you, he bellers out in all of the services. I don't want him to quit. I want him to participate. Okay. Visitors might not think we have concert quality. And that'll be okay. Okay, anybody else have a question? Okay. I'm going to ask this brother to lead us in prayer as we stand. Thank you so much for coming out. I hope I said a few things that are helpful and inspirational.